We're going on a musical journey today in search of roots. Now, when I say roots, I'm talking about biological and evolutionary roots, the how and why our brains understand music. And we begin our journey with a bit of a world tour. This is a choir made up of some of the 300 inhabitants of the Tahitian island of Rapa, singing a song of history and adventure. Here's a Palestinian folk song by the Middle Eastern American music group Anatolia. This is Tuvan throat singing, the musical specialty of the herders of the North Asian plains. And this is the kind of technologically sophisticated, highly produced pop music that dominates Western airwaves. Perhaps the less said, the better. This is just a tiny sample of the incredible variety of music that different human cultures produce and enjoy, although you may not enjoy them all. So, which one did it for you? Did one of those make you smile or wince? Did it arouse your curiosity? Were you humming along, wanting more, or reaching for the radio dial? Likely, one of them did resonate for you. And if it didn't, then I'm sure we could find music that did. Because humans have a special relationship with music, one that we really don't understand yet. We do know that music is universal in human cultures. We've never discovered a society that doesn't produce it. We have evidence of musical instruments that are tens of thousands of years old, predating writing, even agriculture. Music might well have been around as long as humans have, and as a result, human culture is saturated in music. It marks celebrations, it marks mourning, it marks journeys in elevators. We use it to express our most tender feelings and our strongest emotions. So for a scientist, or anyone who's a little bit curious, there's one overriding question. Why? Why is there music? Just think about it, like Dr. David Huron has. Dr. Huron is a professor of music, a composer, and head of the Cognitive and Systematic Musicology Lab at Ohio State University.
If a Martian were to land on Earth and to look at what human beings are engaged in, they would see us a lot of things that would be recognizable to any alien: nurturing offspring, engaged in education, food gathering and food preparation. All of these things would make sense. Music is one of those things that just sort of sticks out. You think, what on earth are people doing here? And just to put it in the context of the economy, people spend an enormous amount of money on music. It's comparable in size to the pharmaceutical industry. So for our visiting Martian, they'd have to kind of scratch their head and think, what is all this about?
Dr. Huron is part of a growing group of researchers trying to figure out what this music is all about. They're using the tools of psychology, neurology, and evolutionary biology to try to untangle the special relationship we humans have with music, why we're so good at it, and why it means so much to us. One of the things that more and more researchers are becoming convinced of is that, as far as music is concerned, we're wired for sound. Dr. Robert Zatori was a professional organist before he began his career as a neuroscientist. Today, he's a professor at the Montreal Neurological Institute at McGill University.
Music is something which seems to exist in all human cultures. Music seems to be something that young infants do without any training. You take a little kid who's being raised without any explicit training, and it will start to sing spontaneously. I think that essentially all normal human beings have quite a sophisticated capacity for music. And again, if you come back to the example of young children do extremely sophisticated things, such as recognize a tune when it's played in a completely different key with a completely different set of instruments, or, you know, sung versus played on a guitar. And that's a very sophisticated pattern recognition capacity that our brains seem to be, quote-unquote, programmed to do. It seems as if there is some kind of neural circuitry that makes the human brain be a musical brain.
So, what does it mean to have a musical brain? Well, at a basic level, it means that we don't have to learn important things about music. Infants instinctively react to lullabies and simple play songs without ever being taught about them. Very young children spontaneously begin to sing along with their parents, not to mention Raffi, Sharon Lois and Bram, and Barney. People who've never taken a music lesson can quickly learn to tap out a familiar tune on a piano keyboard. Contrast this with something like reading, for example, which is actually in some ways a less complex task, but which takes us many years to learn, and many people never do. For scientists, this means that somehow our brains must have a hardwired ability to perceive the patterns of sound that we call music, the specialized neural circuits Dr. Zatori spoke about. These circuits give us the abilities that even the most sophisticated computers don't have. From a piece of music, we can extract tempo, melody, and harmonies. We can filter out individual instruments or contrast what they're playing, and yet somehow also integrate them all into the whole that is the piece of music we're listening to. This is hard stuff, and we don't know how we do it. We just know we can do it. Untangling the how is the job that scientists like Dr. Zatori are tackling, and they're beginning to make progress in identifying exactly what it is about our brains that gives us this remarkable ability.
People sometimes ask me, well, which part of the brain is involved in music? And I usually tell them it's everything above the neck, because after all, music has so many different components to it that clearly it doesn't depend on any one single brain area per se. There are, of course, very high-level cognitive aspects of music that you can introspect about. When you're listening to a piece of music, you might be very consciously listening to a certain theme, or you might be paying special attention to the way the second violin interacts with the first violin. But by the same token, there are a lot of automatic processes that do go into it. I think the aspect that I find most compelling is in the processing of sound patterns. I do think there is probably some specialization for patterns of pitches and changes in pitch and duration that characterize all musical systems.
In other words, we seem to have the ability to carry out sophisticated sound processing in our brains without even being aware of it. For example, we don't need to think about whether one note is higher than another. We can easily recognize the rising and falling contour of the notes in a melody. And we have a remarkable ability to quickly recognize familiar tunes, maybe just by humming a few notes. Of course, you all know, da 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 da. What this suggests to neuroscientists is that there are specific locations in the brain where this sound processing is happening, and that furthermore, these circuits are devoted specifically to music. This conclusion is supported by the work of Dr. Isabel Perret, a classical guitarist and a professor of psychology at McGill University. She's been working with a unique group of brain-injured people who've lost their ability to perceive music.
I've been mostly interested in those subjects who suffer from failures to recognize familiar music. And in fact, their problem is that they no longer recognize the music even of song they knew before. They will say, I don't know what it is, while you are, for example, playing on a keyboard the melody of Happy Birthday. They no longer can perceive the melodic variations.
The patients Dr. Peretz has been investigating have a rare condition called amusia. Originally, their musical abilities had been normal or even exceptional, but their brains were injured through accident or damage in surgery in a very limited way, resulting in small lesions in the auditory cortex. And while their disability is a curiosity, what's more remarkable for Dr. Peretz is that they're otherwise completely normal.
It's quite clear that their deficit is really, really limited to one particular field, and the field is music. I mean, they have no problem, nothing. I mean, they have normal intelligence, they interact with you verbally as they did before, they have no problem to recognize your voice, they have an excellent memory, they can recognize all the sounds around them. So it's highly specific, and the only way to understand this kind of condition is to accept that somewhere in the brain there are specialized areas that were damaged in these people.
Since they're not associated with any other kind of problem, Dr. Perret says it's very hard to imagine that such losses don't involve a very specific kind of brain tissue, tissue that's devoted to music. This sort of evidence has led some researchers to try to find exactly where this circuitry might be located in the brain. Dr. Satori has used brain imaging techniques like functional magnetic resonance imaging and positron emission tomography, or PET scanning, to try to pinpoint those areas of the brain that might be specific to music. And that's led him to an interesting discovery about the differences between the auditory areas of the left and the right brain.
If you look at the function of the left auditory areas, what they seem to be really good at is tracking information that is very rapidly changing. And that is the case for speech. If you look at the spectrogram of a speech signal, as I'm talking to you right now, these sounds are coming at you extremely quickly. And what distinguishes one speech sound from another can be as little as 10 milliseconds. So the difference between pig and big is something around 10 or 20 milliseconds. So what we find is that the auditory cortex on the right side seems to have a different set of characteristics. It seems to be a little bit less good at tracking these rapid changes, and it seems to be a lot better than the one on the left at tracking the frequency changes. And so the way we see it is as if we have two parallel systems, each of which has been tweaked in opposite directions. And so in this sense, the nervous system has adapted to have the best of both worlds.
Dr. Satori has further discovered that this segregation between the left and right auditory cortex of the brain is not just geographical. He's found evidence that the neurons themselves are actually different. The language-biased neurons in the left brain have more of an insulating coating called myelin than those neurons on the right side. Myelin allows nerves to fire more quickly, but tends to reduce their sensitivity. So the nerves of the left auditory cortex are upgraded for speed. In contrast, the nerves with less myelin on the right side of the brain are optimized for sensitivity, especially for changes in pitch, and therefore especially for music. Studies like these are just the first steps in trying to work out exactly what in the brain makes us so good at music, and there's a lot more work to do. But at the same time, other researchers are interested in investigating not just what's going on in the brain as we hear music, but what's going on as we play it. That takes us to the Rotman Research Institute in Toronto. We drop by the laboratory in which violinist and neuroscientist Dr. Christo Pantev performs his brain imaging experiments with his giant magnetic encephalography machine.
Okay. Hi.
Hello. Hi. My goodness. Looks like we're going into a vault here.
No, we are going into a magnetically shielded room with a weight of about 7 tons that prevent external magnetic fields to come into the room. So inside of the room, we are magnetically shielded. This looks like as a huge hair dryer. Of course, we don't dry the hairs. We are picking up the activity of cortical neurons, their magnetic activity, so it can detect very fast changes in the brain activity. So we see the neuronal activity of the human brain.
The magnetic encephalography machine is the closest thing we have to a mind reader. It can trace the firing of neurons with a resolution of millimeters. Using this technique, Dr. Pantev has made some quite remarkable discoveries about how much the brain can change with exposure to music. He's done much of his work looking at the somatosensory cortex. This is the part of the brain that we use to perceive our own bodies, with bundles of nerves corresponding to the hands, the feet, the lips, and every other body part. In one study, Dr. Pantev examined the brains of cellists and violinists.
Their fingers of the both hands are differently involved in the production of music. They use the fingers of the left hand much more than the fingers of the right hand that are moving the bow. And we found in violin and cello players, as compared to
controls who never played an instrument, that indeed the cortical representation or the representation in the brain of the fingers of the left hand is much more pronounced than those of the right hand. But also compare the cortical representation of the left hand with the cortical representation of the left hand of non-musician, it was significantly more represented.
What Dr. Pantev discovered was a surprising example of the phenomenon researchers call neural plasticity, the way the brain can change in response to the demands we make on it. For the average person, the fingers only need a certain amount of brain tissue to give us the sensitivity and fine motor control for ordinary tasks. But cellists and violinists need much more. They need better control and sensitivity in their left hands, which are used to finger the strings. So their brains respond by giving these areas more neurons to work with, and by increasing the efficiency and coordination of those neurons. What's also interesting is that Dr. Pantev has discovered that the maximum amount of neurons the brain would recruit to this task is age-dependent. The earlier musicians started in their childhood, the more neurons the brain would give to the fingers. In essence, this provides a potential explanation for why an early start can be so important for musicians. It means they can actually have more brain power devoted to their instrument. So now we're approaching an understanding of the mystery of how we can play and perceive music so well. But what about the why of music? If our brains are wired for music, then we need to start thinking about why these biological features might have first appeared. And that raises the question of evolution. Is our musical ability an adaptation, selected for because music gives us an evolutionary advantage? Or is it an evolutionary accident, a byproduct of the complexity of our huge brains? The key here may lie in the connection between music and pleasure.
If I could save time in a bottle, the first thing that I'd like to do is to...
Now, I don't know about you, but that tune just does it for me. I can't hear it without feeling a rush of emotion and chills up my spine. It just has an incredibly powerful effect on me. Now, I admit, Jim Croce doesn't do it for everybody, but I'm willing to bet that most of you can think of a song that does the same thing, that just brings on an almost physical wave of emotion. In fact, that phenomenon is so strong, Dr. Robert Satori was interested in finding out what was going on in the brain as people experienced it.
What we did was we put people in one of our brain scanning devices, and we asked them to select pieces of music that they knew would give them the chills. Now, when we looked at the brain activity, we saw the areas of the brain that are typically thought of as being involved in emotional reward or motivation. And these are very ancient systems that have been identified in many other studies that are known to be active when you have an extremely pleasurable sensation, usually associated with a biologically significant event. For example, if you receive food when you're hungry. But we saw this when people were simply listening to this music that made them feel really good.
The discovery that music can apparently act directly on the pleasure centers of the brain is an important one from an evolutionary perspective. It raises a fundamental question about music, according to musicologist and cognitive scientist Dr. David Huron.
Evolutionary biologists make a distinction between adaptive pleasure-seeking behavior and non-adaptive pleasure-seeking behavior. So an example of adaptive pleasure-seeking behaviors would be eating. Enjoying eating is a great way of getting nutrition. Enjoying sex is a great way to get an organism to engage in procreation. On the other hand, we can figure out ways to sort of circumvent these behaviors and get at the pleasure-creating mechanism directly. In modern society, we can load up on sugars and fats in our diets in a way that's, although it's pleasurable, is not really good for us. It leads to diabetes and obesity and all sorts of bad things. Or an even better example would be injecting heroin. You want to feel good, just inject this substance. It's clearly non-adaptive pleasure-seeking. So from a musical standpoint, the $64,000 question about music is music adaptive pleasure-seeking, or is it non-adaptive pleasure-seeking, like injecting heroin? And as a musician, I'd like to hold out the hope that music making really has an adaptive pleasure-seeking component to it, rather than having this in common with, say, heroin as being non-adaptive.
This is a tough question to answer, as the whys of evolution always are. After all, Homo habilis wasn't taking notes on the tunes sung around the antelope carcass 2 million years ago for a review in Rolling Stone. What researchers are left with is a kind of guessing game, trying to generate a convincing argument for why music could have been valuable to our ancestors and thus selected for over countless generations.
It's very clear our love is here to stay.
Some have suggested that perhaps music evolved in humans for the same reason it evolved in birds, a way to attract mates and increase sexual desirability. A more popular theory is that music's value lies in creating social bonds among groups of humans. We're familiar with how a song around a campfire or a rousing anthem can make us feel more part of a larger whole. These bonds could be a kind of evolutionary advantage, allowing individuals to cooperate in hunting or mutual protection. Yet another theory suggests that it might be as simple as the bond between mother and child.
Hush, little baby, don't say a word. Mama's gonna buy you a mockingbird.
Dr. Laurel Trainer is a psychologist at McMaster University in Hamilton, and she's interested in the way that infants perceive music. Dr. Trainer thinks that a mother's songs and the stereotypical sing-song voice she'll use with a baby are part of an important communication strategy. Any parent knows the power of music over infants. A lullaby can work magic to calm a screaming baby. And to attract a baby's attention and distract it from chewing on an extension cord, nothing works better than a play song. Dr. Trainer thinks the way mothers and babies use music reveals a possible evolutionary route for it.
Well, of course, everything evolutionary is speculative, but I think one of the most compelling notions is the idea that music evolved through mother-infant interaction. Human infants are helpless for much longer than any other species, but they require so they require mothers to be in close contact with them for years. And especially in those early months before they develop language or other means of controlling their behavior and protecting them from dangers, music may have provided initially a window into allowing mothers to control the state of their infant, help protect them, keep in close contact with them. So some people have speculated that that, in fact, was the origin of music, and that language was an offshoot of music. That once we had developed this sort of temporal and spectral patterning and the ability to process it and so on, we could then use those abilities to attach specific meanings to auditory stimuli.
Dr. Trainer's argument, and the other ones like it, are interesting speculations, but it's hard to know what to do with this information. Certainly, it can give us some insight into the way our brains work, which is why many neuroscientists are so interested in music. But it doesn't really say much about music itself. We value music as one of our highest cultural achievements. We value it for the way it can represent our dreams and emotions with such clarity and beauty. Evolution may have little to say about this, but on the other hand, it might have a lot to say about what kind of creatures we are. Dr. Huron.
If we're talking about music as an evolutionary adaptation, it's important that we don't think of it in terms of the way we understand music today. That is, the music of the Pleistocene caveman is not going to be the music of AC/DC or Brahms. It's going to be a very different thing, and we shouldn't be judging how that might function according to contemporary ways of functioning. But if it were the case that we could identify music as being an evolutionary adaptation, we could take some consolation in that. It would be marvelous. Music has always been part of what makes human beings distinctive, and wouldn't it be lovely to find out that it's not just what makes us distinctive from a cultural perspective, but that it's somehow deeply embedded in what it means to be a Homo sapien? That would be a wonderful thing to know.
Ain't got no troubles in my life, no foolish dreams to make me cry. I'm never frightened or worried. I know I'll always